And you may have heard that last month, the publisher Scholastic stopped distribution of the children's book, A Birthday Cake for George Washington, because it featured Washington's slave chef Hercules and his daughter, actual historical figures, happily baking a cake for their owner, the first president. Critics said they were slaves. How happy could they be? Then the National Coalition Against Censorship objected, saying readers should draw their own conclusions. But how can you? Well, maybe by reading another new book. Our next guest has deeply researched the lives of slaves in the White House. Jesse Holland is also a regular guest on our weekly 2016 Roundtable. He covers politics for the AP. His new book is called The Invisibles, The Untold Story of African-American Slaves in the White House. Jesse, hi.
How are you today?
I'm good, because this was a terrific read. It was fascinating. I thought I knew things, but learned more. But let's start with Hercules. He's a dandy who, you know, dresses to the nines. He walks around the streets of Philadelphia, where the first capital of the country was, and people know him. He tips his hat. Maybe he baked some cakes for Washington in his day.
Right.
But you write he actually escaped from slavery on the night of Washington's 65th birthday. So how would you characterize Hercules' relationship with George Washington?
Well, one of the things you have to keep in mind about Hercules is that for most of his life, he had a better life than most of the slaves at Mount Vernon. He was a cook, so that meant that he was on the inside. He didn't have to work the fields. Mm-hmm. And he was actually well known for the work that he did. He actually could make extra money by cooking for other people. But part of the reason why we think he escaped is because he had sort of fallen out of favor with the Washingtons. And Hercules was actually, for the first time in his life, going to be sent out to the fields to work.
This was because George Washington suspected Hercules' son of stealing. And so he thought, let's keep him all out of mischief. And he takes him out of his chef cap and puts him in a field.
Right. And so Hercules decided that he wasn't going to stand for it. And one day he just got up and walked off.
Yeah. Well, this also happened to Martha Washington's slave, who was like a daughter to her, Oney.
Oney Judge. Yes. The same thing happened with her. Oney had a great life as well. That's really a great life as far as you can have as a slave at her time. But the Washingtons were doing something a bit sneaky. Once in Pennsylvania, slave owners could only keep their slaves there for 6 months. And after that 6 month, the slaves would automatically become free.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Washingtons would do is they would send their slaves home every 5 months in about 2 weeks and then bring them to Mount Vernon and then bring them back. So Oney Judge kept watching this process happen over and over. And as the Washingtons came closer and closer to the end of his term as president, Oney decided she didn't want to go back to Mount Vernon. So one day while the Washingtons were having dinner at their house, she got on a ship and she sailed north.
And went up to New Hampshire. Look, how should we look at this? History plays such tricks on us, such mind tricks, because I bet people impose their own politics on these historical figures. So you might think George Washington, he must have been a progressive because he led the country to revolution. And then you're reading about that he owned slaves. I mean, yes, they were inherited, but he owned slaves. And he, for instance, signed the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, allowing for slaves to be recaptured and sent back to their masters. It jars with the image that we might have with our founding fathers.
I never knew that George Washington actually attempted to capture escaped slaves like Oney Judge and Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
What we were taught in school was George Washington, father of your country. George Washington leads the colonies to victory over the British forces. We didn't learn all of these details. That's sort of what I'm trying to do with this project, trying to get into the details of not just the presidents, but the people in their households, these slaves that made it possible for George Washington to be president because they took care of everything else.
Well, there was William Lee, who was Washington's body man, with him every single second, dressing him at Valley Forge, yet always slaves. Move on to the Madisons, James and Dolly. Dolly Madison does not come off well here.
No, she doesn't. One of the great things that I found working with this book was about Paul Jennings. Paul Jennings was the slave of James and Dolly Madison, and he actually writes the first tell-all book about life inside the White House. Now, the story that most people know about Dolly Madison is that Dolly Madison, when the British are invading Washington, D.C., she runs and saves the famous portrait of George Washington that hangs in the White House, and she gets it out of the White House. Well, Paul Jennings comes along later and says, well, you know, Dolly Madison actually had nothing to do with taking the painting down. Now, part of the reason why he might have written that, James Madison at his death had promised Paul Jennings his freedom. But by the time James Madison dies, Dolly Madison doesn't have that much money.
Thanks to a hapless son, was it?
And thanks to a ne'er-do-well son.
Right.
So she reneges upon James Madison's promise to Paul Jennings, and she keeps him in slavery. He luckily gets sold to someone who actually cared about him enough to let him free a few years later after he works off a debt. And when Dolly Madison actually does become destitute, he's one of the people who brings her food and money to help her survive.
It's an incredible image of this now freed slave being the one to turn around and help the slave mistress who had not been kind to him.
Right. I mean, it's just amazing some of these stories that I found in this book.
You don't think well, frankly, of a lot of the presidents and their families and the way they treated slaves, especially since we're reminded that, as you said, Pennsylvania didn't have slaves, New Hampshire didn't. The abolitionist movement was well underway. So they don't come off looking well. But then you have Andrew Jackson, who was just beloved by his slaves.
It's one of the amazing things. And Andrew Jackson, a Southerner, a man who is known for his rough and ready temper, a general who's known for being fierce. But despite being a slave owner, Andrew Jackson was actually seemed to have actually cared about his slaves to the point where he would attack a white man who attacked one of his slaves. He would use his influence and power to defend slaves when they were falsely accused. And so he engendered a type of loyalty that you wouldn't expect that a slave would actually have for a person who owns him. But he engendered that type of loyalty to the point where when he died, two of his most favorite slaves stayed at the Hermitage and became fixtures there, living their life there.
Was this Gracie?
This is Gracie and Alfred Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up being like basically the heart and soul for the Hermitage. Now, Gracie's story is interesting because she was actually purchased by Andrew Jackson while he was president here in Washington, D.C., making Jackson like the first president that we know of to actually purchase a slave while president. Even after he left Washington, D.C., Andrew Jackson took Gracie along with him. She ends up marrying his second favorite slave, Alfred Jackson, and they end up living their lives out there at the Hermitage even after they were freed. They actually ended up having a house on the Hermitage grounds.
Yeah. It's so painful, though, to read that more often a slave would implore, and we have these letters that you find and have been kept, they'd implore if they could please, can I please go to this part of the plantation or so that I can marry the slave. And there'd be this sort of callous, no. Families were kept apart. There were presidents, John Adams, his son John Quincy Adams, did not have slaves. They were Quakers. They didn't believe in it. And it made for a rough time in the White House because it was hard to afford it. The slaves built the White House. We know that story well. But there are just still so many contradictions. We have to come to Thomas Jefferson, fought against laws that would have led to the permanent enslavement of blacks in his home state, Virginia. But he was, of course, a slave owner who had six children with Sally Hemings.
Right. Thomas Jefferson is just a bundle of contradictions. He actually wanted a former slave to be the first White House chef. This ends up being Sally Hemings' brother, James Hemings. But their negotiations didn't work out right, so that didn't happen. But with Thomas Jefferson, one of the threads I saw throughout the book, throughout the presidents, is that they knew morally slavery was wrong. But financially, it was the only way that they could keep their financial status. That's the only way they could stay rich, basically, is by using human slaves.
Well, meanwhile, the stories are so compelling. And the names, I mean, they stay with you. William and Suki and Mary Ellen and Oney.
Right.
What did it mean for you, an African-American, to, I mean, as you point out, many of them just disappear from history's pages. What did it mean for you to be able to line these names up in this book?
One of the things that I loved about working on this project is that for me, this is a story I wanted to read. I wanted to know who these people were. When Barack Obama was first elected, everyone talked about, wow, there's going to be a black president in the White House. But I knew that he couldn't have been the first black person to live there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know who they were. And it was so difficult finding out these people's names, simply because they were considered property during their time. The places where you found them were in ledgers. For me, that's the joy I get of reading and telling mm-hmm. people these stories. It restores some of the dignity these men and women had that was taken away from them through slavery.
So you can read Jesse Holland's The Invisibles, The Untold Story of African-American Slaves in the White House, or you can get a children's book about slaves happily baking a cake. Jesse, it really is a terrific read. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll see you at the 2016 Roundtable. Jesse covers politics for the AP. Thank you.
Thank you so much.